We're going to start our luncheon keynote. Thank you. I'm very pleased and proud on behalf of the American Academy and CSIS to introduce our luncheon speaker, Ambassador Andrew Natsios, administrator, ambassador, professor, envoy. I don't know how many titles Andrew has or which one he prefers, but he's a Georgetown University colleague, and we're very proud of that. Andrew served in 06 and 07 as President George W. Bush's Sudan envoy, as you know. He served as administrator of AID between 01 and 05. He has a long history and great expertise in the area of humanitarian response, has written widely about it, and his books are still in print, so I recommend that you check them out. I first worked with Andrew when he was doing OFDA, and that goes back a ways. But the special relevance of having Andrew Natsios with us here at lunch, I want to put into a context, because this is a meeting, this is a workshop on diplomacy and how to re-energize and re-empower American diplomacy in a context in which sometimes people think that the uniformed military are taking over everything. And I think what Andrew wants to talk about, and I'll let him define it, is the place, the strategic role of development assistance and assistance generally in American foreign policy. So with those few words, Andrew, the mic is yours if you want to stand here or sit, whichever is your preference.
Thank you, Chet. I will stand if I could. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a little nervous, though. I know many of you, but Mark, I didn't see you there. I see Dick Boghossian, and I see Francis eating there. Are you going to eat while I talk, Francis? And many of us have worked together on various crises. Francis and I go back to Somalia, where we were on this team. Yes, something I haven't put in my resume, Francis. Anyway. What I'd like to do is focus on the Beltway, because the Beltway is the problem. The principal problem of aid in Africa is this, not us here. At least I hope not. It is the Beltway. There is political dynamics in the United States that have distorted our aid program in a way that has been very destructive, in my view, in the field. And the implications cascade down. Now, the reason I'm really focused on this is I'm writing a book about it. And the book looks at the clashes that development assistance, the problems it has here in the city, and then what the implications are for the business model of the agency, and then how this stuff gets played out in the field and the missions. And when I first started at AID, people said, you know, everybody in AID wants to get out of Washington as soon as possible, because from our perspective, this is the center of the dysfunction, is the city. And the political pressures in the city and the pressures in the system. So you can't disconnect the two. And so I want to make some initial comments, because there is a process in the administration. Apparently there are dueling reviews now of diplomacy and development, one going on at the State Department and one going on at the White House. Apparently there are two administrations in one. And I think it's a little odd. I know what's going on. I'm the Obama transition team for AID did a brilliant report, and it's been dumped in the wastebasket. All of the people who were experts in the Obama campaign are now sort of in exile in the White House, because they're not in the State Department. You know who's in the State Department. So there is a little problem. It's a political problem. I observe it as a Republican from the outside, but it's troubling to me in a little bit, because the body over which this fight is taking place is AID. It's not because AID is hated, although there are certain people that do. It is because there is a debate, at least among some people, about the relevance of the State Department, which I have to say I do not share at all. I am very disturbed by some of the trends. The trend is now, some of you may not even know this, that they're not going to be appointing as many ambassadors from the ranks of political officers. They're going to have the management officers now, in many regions of the world, career officers, become the ambassadors. Now, and that's what's happened at AID in the 1990s. If you look at who's the mission directors, they're lawyers, procurement officers, and accounts. You know why? Because that's the first point I want to make. the regulatory apparatus in Washington, the Inspector General's office, and in the case of Iraq, the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction, OMB, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, the GIPRA, you know what GIPRA is? That terrible law that was passed in 1993, which supposedly quantifies every single dollar spent by the U.S. government on anything, not just, this is not directed at us in the foreign aid community, but it's for the whole federal government. And then there's the GAO. I mean, there's so many. It's called the counter bureaucracy. There's a whole scholarly literature on this. Nothing to do with foreign policy. And it's turning the whole federal government into a giant production system. It's industrializing our government in a very interesting way, which is appropriate for the Social Security Administration. You carry out a repetitive function that's the same in every office, everywhere in the world. There's one law. I mean, but doing that in foreign aid, in my view, is an utter disaster. Culture and values and history and location have a profound effect on development. And if you start creating a production-like, which is what, and we have an example of this on a massive scale, which is the very well-known and very popular program on HIV/AIDS, the President's PEPFAR program. If you actually look, though, at what it's become, it's a service delivery program. And it's created a parallel set of institutions that are run out of the United States, out of AID and CDC, to administer the program. And there are certain consequences to it. The focus of the program is not institution building in the health sector in Africa. It is on delivery of services. And that's where the whole aid program is moving. Now, people think that we in aid made the decision to do this. There is enormous resistance in AID to doing this. I mean, people complain about it constantly. But we don't have much choice. The regulatory apparatus, I call them the regulatory lords. Rodney Bent, my good friend, got very personally offended when I said this in a meeting. And I said, Rodney, this is not a personal attack on you. You're the only person that was rational in the OMB when I was there, in AID. And if you weren't there, we would have all jumped out the window. But the fact is that OMB is part of the problem. And they're part of this apparatus. And the apparatus is driving all of this toward short-term interventions that can produce visible, measurable results that are dramatic and sort of, they're real wonderful for public diplomacy. They have very little to do, however, with development. I've been writing this book, I've been looking back at the last 50 years of AID, even AID in its predecessor agencies in the 1950s, to see what worked. The Help Commission was supposed to do this. They did not do this. What they did is they sort of trashed the old system. The old system before the 1990s was actually very successful in doing a lot of very interesting things around the world that almost no one knows about. I didn't know this until last summer, but there's a couple of hundred interviews with career AID and state foreign service officers at the National Archives on the website. And some of these interviews, I had one of my graduate students read them all. He spent the whole summer reading them. He said one of them was 300 pages long by a senior aid officer. And if you really want to find out what worked and what did, you get to read the commentary on these things failed, these things work. What works and what doesn't work? Well, the first thing is, if you don't build an institutional basis in the societies, the programs are unsustainable. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's in the public sector, the nonprofit sector, or even the profit-making sector. Secondly, it takes a long time to do this stuff successfully. The old aid model was 10-year programs. 5 years and 5 years. You know what they are now? 2 years. You can't do a sustainable program in 2 years. You can deliver services, and you can comply with the quantitative indicator requirements of GIPRA and of the IG and of the OMB. You know, this program's not working. Well, I said, the program is a year old. It will take 10 years to make this work. He said, well, you don't have 10 years. In all of the old AID, if you ask the officers, and I did 77 interviews of people at the World Bank, the UN, AID, it's very interesting what the most significant program was in terms of success, and that's the scholarship programs. When John Blackton was sent in to shut down the AID program in Turkey because it had graduated, he asked many civil servants and civil society, what's the most important thing AID did in Turkey all these years? And they said, well, you trained about 6,000 Turks who are now running the country in the civil service. They're the senior people running the bureaucracy, and they got their PhDs or master's degree from American universities in the United States, and the scholarships weren't just randomly chosen. They were in specific ministries and institutions to build up the capacity, because we learned early on, if you just get one person in a scholarship and they go back to a ministry that's dysfunctional, they will get depressed and actually quit or leave. You got to do the whole ministry. And we can actually show huge progress in whole sectors of a country by making sure all of the people in the ministry go to the same school. For example, the Ministry of Agriculture in Dominican Republic over 10 years all went to Texas A&M and got their degrees. And the ministry, if you go to rural Dominican Republic and then rural Haiti, you can see the difference. It is a remarkable difference. And I asked people why, and they said the Ministry of Agriculture is very progressive and very competent. Guess how many scholarships we used to do? We used to do 20,000 scholarships a year. You know what we do now? 900. You know why? OMB said, well, what are the indicators showing results? We want results. I said, well, the results are in 20 years, these people will be in senior positions and they'll affect policy. He said, well, 20 years? You can't be serious. These programs are all gone. And they wiped all the programs out, literally. Now, other things contributed, tuition costs and all that. The net effect, though, is the sustainability of the program is now seriously in question. And it is not just me who's observing this. Laurie Garrett wrote a very critical article about the PEPFAR program in Foreign Affairs, and she had death threats against her when she wrote it. I've had threats against me when I say critical. You're not supposed to say critical things because it makes, and there's a scandalous amount of money. I say that very carefully. Money was sent back in Kenya from the AID mission. So in PEPFAR, we can't spend this money. There's no institutional way possibly to spend all this money. In Ethiopia, one of the poorest countries in the world, I mean, I love Ethiopia, but 50% of the aid program, which is over $500 million now, is PEPFAR. PEPFAR. And another 38% is food aid. 7% is child survival population and malaria. 1.5% is for agriculture. 1.5% for education. 1.5% for governance. When I went to the AID mission in Ethiopia and I said to the staff, you know, I always meet with the FSNs and the career officers, of course, in aid when I go to the field. And we would have an open conversation. And I had this lady stand up and she said, Mr. Natsios, when are you going to send us more governance money? The place is soaked with health money. The place is coming down, coming apart with health money. I said, are you a democracy and governance officer, which is our backstop, you call them cones in the State Department, in AID they're called backstops. And she said, no, I'm a health officer. I said, so health officers are now saying there's too much health money. I said, this is really serious when this happens. You know, so there's something wrong. What is it that's wrong? Well, what's happened essentially is that interest groups drive the process in the United States. I mean, I come from the NGO community, but the NGO community has formed a group of coalitions to push more money into the budget for certain sectors. Sectors that have an earmark with a strong, aggressive, almost ruthless devotion to their sector get big earmarks, and those which do not, there's no agriculture sector earmark, none. There is no democracy and governance earmark. The two things that the heads of state in Africa have asked me more times than anything else, when are you going to give us more money for roads in the rural areas, Andrew? When are you going to give us more money for democracy and governance? I mean, they call it governance money. We need, the ministries need help, and you're not providing it. And then economic growth. These are the areas. There are no earmarks for any of these. And so whenever an earmark is increased without a corresponding increase in the baseline of the AID budget, all of the discretionary money gets sucked up. The ESF account now, which is $2.9 billion, this is the State Department, most of you know what ESF is. Guess how much of it in the old days was earmarked? Virtually none. 20 years ago, almost none of the money was sectorally earmarked. I just did the calculations this morning in the latest budget, $2.9 billion for ESF. The only discretionary money left in that account is $67 million. All of the rest of it is completely earmarked. That means ambassadors and aid mission directors have no discretion. And the F process, which I think personally is a disaster, I understand why they did it. It made things worse, not better. It centralized control over spending out of the regional bureaus in AID and state, and it's supposed to have rationalized the process of allocation. Let me give you one of the consequences of this allocation. The greatest success of AID in its history is the Green Revolution. Dorman Borlaug just died, and I asked Dr. Borlaug one night at dinner when he was doing well in his 92 at a dinner, and I said, I understand, Dr. Borlaug, that the three institutions that made the most difference to you in getting this implemented was the World Bank, AID, and the Rockefeller. And then he went into a rage. He said, it was not the World Bank. They were useless. Every time I'd ask them, they wouldn't help me, Andrew. It's AID. Without AID, there would have been no Green Revolution. He was yelling at me, 92-year-old man, who's a peace, you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize, who saved probably 300 million people's lives. That's the estimate of how many people. He eliminated famine in Asia except for what happened in North Korea, which never got the Green Revolution. Guess what F did? F eliminated all the funding because the agriculture people weren't there to protect the account in AID for the CGIR system, the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, which was set up in the 1960s to back up the Green Revolution. Dr. Borlaug's from the CGIR system. The largest donor since the 1960s, without any question, has always been AID. I increased the funding to $45 million a year. In 1 year, it was all wiped out. Why? I asked the question. Why? Because there's no discretionary money left. All the other earmarks are sucking the money up. And because someone decided in F, apparently a political person, not a career person, that they didn't want any central money going to any programs anymore. I said, well, the CGR system is an international institution. You can't send it from the missions. The money has to go from a central pot. And it's always gone from this account. Well, the system has been disrupted. In 1 year, now Dr. Borlaug started a whole campaign to restore the cut, and he did. But friends of mine, they said they had to do mass layoffs at this CGIR system. The base now for continuing the Green Revolution is the CGIR system, which is now in very serious trouble because of these cuts, arbitrary cuts that they were. I don't think the process is improved. It's separating the budgeteers from the technical experts who are supposed to be running these programs. And the literature is huge on the most successful approach to development from a management standpoint, a highly decentralized approach that's driven from the field. That is not what's happening to this system. The system, AID, was the most decentralized of all aid agencies in the world. It's now the most centralized. Now, let me move to what that means in terms of Africa and what we should be moving to. Let me be a little bit nicer and more positive in terms of what should happen. One comment before I make that. And that, we used to put money every year, because I'm really focused in agriculture, or I was aid administrator, and Congress would take the money out and put it into something else. And I'll tell you candidly, my legislative people would come in and say, Andrew, they gutted the whole thing. All your huge, we hired more agricultural economists and scientists in Africa because we were going to start a second Green Revolution, but there's no money to start it with. The staff kept saying, well, Andrew, you hired all these people, well, there's no money. I said, look. And I checked to see what happened. I'm just being candid with you. The environmental NGOs said you cannot trust AID with money. They will do irrigation. I said, well, God forbid we do irrigation. 7% of agriculture in Africa is irrigated, which is why they have famines when there's droughts. You know, if you're a subsistence farmer and there's 100% crop loss, you're in big trouble. You have to increase irrigation. We don't like irrigation. We don't like chemical fertilizer. The most expensive fertilizer in the world in terms of a region is in Africa, both because of the roads and other reasons. But without putting more nitrogen in the soil, there would be no Green Revolution in Asia. You have to put nitrogen in the soil, and Norman Borlaug has publicly said this. The environmental movement thinks it's very destructive to put anything back in the soil except the manure, basically. You have to have compost. You can't use chemical fertilizer. And third, they don't like improved seed varieties, GMO seed. We were building seed institutes in Africa to develop their own seed varieties, and they went crazy over that, and I got attacked. People demanded my resignation for poisoning Africans with technology that might increase crop yields. So, and then, on the other side, we had the agriculture industry that said, wait a second, if they grow more food, they're not going to buy our food. So you had an unholy alliance in the Congress lobbying against more agriculture money. First, it's the environmental groups, and I don't mean all of them. I mean, the Africa Wildlife Foundation is one of my favorite NGOs, and they understand you have to do this stuff. But some of the other more extreme groups take the view, no scientific agriculture. It's sort of Paleolithic agriculture. That's what they think is going to save Africa. I mean, none of them are eating Paleolithic agricultural food. They're eating, you know, scientifically produced food. And then the other side is during the Green Revolution, the agriculture department prohibited aid from doing anything to increase crop yields in rice or wheat, which is what the Green Revolution was all about. And corn. Why did they do that? Because they said they're destroying our markets, which is not true. I mean, actually, India now buys more American food than it did before the Green Revolution, a lot more food. And so does South Korea, both of whom went through the Green Revolution. So it is not true. It's a very parochial thing. We try to do local purchase of food aid. 25% of Title II we were proposing be purchased locally. It was a reform. President Bush agreed to it. He had it in his budget. And we try to get it through. I lobbied. I got committee chairman. And there was the coalition on food aid said, oh, no, we can't. This would be terrible. I said, terrible? I mean, there's a surplus of food in Kenya. We can't buy it for southern Sudan. What's so terrible about that? It saves shipping costs. It's much faster to deliver it. And it stimulates agricultural production in Kenya. Well, the shipping companies in the United States, which ship the food, now won't be shipping the food. I said, yeah, that saves a lot of money. 30-40% of the cost of food aid is shipping costs. We went through all this. The week after I went to Georgetown, my old staff and aide called up and said, you know what USDA just did? They went into OMB and got your language on the local purchase of food aid taken out of the president's budget. They waited for you to leave, and they went in and did that. So I called Josh Bolton up and say, Josh, this is outrageous. 70% of our food aid goes to Africa. We need to stimulate more local production, and this is an excellent way to do it. He put it back in and overruled USDA. Now people in Washington are seriously talking about having USDA, the administration is talking about it now, having USDA, whose purpose in life is to protect American agriculture with subsidies, et cetera, which has done a lot of damage to agricultural production in Africa. We all know that, okay? And so they want USDA to do American agriculture work in the third world. I mean, that is like putting an arsonist in charge of running the fire departments of Washington. The biggest opponent to the Green Revolution in the United States was the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And they're now going to put agriculture programs in the United States under USDA's control. That's the worst idea I have ever heard. I've never heard anything so stupid in my... That's what people are talking about seriously. They have expertise. I said they have expertise because in the mid-1990s, when all the layoffs were taking place in AID, all the agricultural economists who created the Green Revolution were laid off, and the scientists. If I sound a little angry, I'm just trying to keep you all awake. Where should we go? One, we need to return to institution building, capacity building, and not service delivery. And this does not necessarily mean through... If the ministries are led by corrupt or predatory figures, you don't want to invest money because you're not going to build any institutions. One of the lessons we've learned in all the literature is you need to choose your shots. We invested a lot of money in Afghanistan. Ron Newman knows this very well. We worked together on this. In the health ministry, which was always been well-led, even, believe it or not, under Taliban. The only minister that survived the change of government was the woman general who was in the Taliban. And she never wore a burqa, I might add. And she ran the ministry even under Karzai. Very competent lady, very good doctor, and she helped build a modern ministry of health. There's been a 25% reduction in child and maternal mortality in Afghanistan. This worked. Now, they're telling us now, you need to do this in all the ministries. I said, fine. When President Karzai appoints competent ministers who are not predatory and deputies and undersecretaries in those ministries, we would be glad to go in. What we've learned is if you have a reform-minded minister who wants to make changes, that's where you invest your money. You don't invest it equally everywhere because it won't work. Of course, the earmarks are designed not around the competence of individual ministries in individual countries, which is a local decision that the aid mission and the embassy should make. It's decided here. So you shove the money, the PEPFAR money and all this other money for health into countries that have terrible ministries of health. You're not exactly contributing to the development process. So the first thing I would say is we need to refocus on the long term, on institution building, on sustainability, and to focus again what we used to do in policy dialogue. Because policy dialogue is the way in which you begin to get policy changes. And finally, I would say we need to do in our capacity building efforts to through scholarship programs, and there's some very interesting ways. The University of, I think it was Michigan State under Peter McPherson, said the cost of tuition is so high now, what we're going to do for a master's program is this. And he gave me an example. We're going to have a two-year master's program. We'll have the students come from the developing country to Michigan State for 1 year, and the second year they will study in their own country, but we will second professors from Michigan State to the local university in an organized fashion on a larger scale, and this reduces the cost dramatically of the scholarship, of the cost of the two-year master's program. And it also means that when they finish their master's degree, they will be physically in the country. And that's one way of ensuring that they stay in country instead of staying here. But it reduces the cost, and it builds capacity in these universities. So I think the scholarship program in Africa, since it was a base, 60% of all the agricultural scientists and economists in the world, in the developing world, were, when I started at AID, you know what the percentage is now, were educated on USAID scholarships to Americans' agricultural schools. 60%. We don't do any of that almost anymore. I try to revive it, and again, we didn't have a lot of support for it. The final comment I would make is this. We need to disaggregate Africa. Treating Ghana like the Congo is not a particularly useful enterprise. Now, I don't know if the Congolese ambassador is here. I don't want to be offensive. But, you know, there are certain problems in Congo that are very different than Ghana's problems. I think we actually should move more money through the ministries in Ghana because they have proven that they're at the stage of development where reform is actually what they're engaged in, transformational development. And they've now discovered oil, and the country's going to take off. It already has taken off. But in DROC, we need to take a different approach. Putting money through the ministries is not a wise decision, which some of the Europeans are doing. In my view, it's a disaster. So I think we need separate strategies with separate implementation mechanisms in fragile states, a separate mechanism for failed and failing states, and then finally, countries engaged in reform at a transformational moment need to have a third way of approaching development from an implementation standpoint. If we do that, those reforms, I think, and we get rid of all these earmarks, I think we could have a very powerful program. It's not how much money we spend. It's how we spend it that counts. Thank you very much.
Andrew, I think you have succeeded in keeping everybody stimulated and awake despite having just had a nice lunch. And we thank you for being provocative and keeping us on our toes. There was a discussion before you arrived, and I'm going to ask the first question and then recognize people. And please, when you do grab the microphone, introduce yourself. There was a discussion earlier about the trade-off between the way state does business and the way AFRICOM and the Defense Department do business. AFRICOM is capable of thinking and acting regionally. Princeton, I think you raised this point, whereas the State Department is organized in terms of bilateral country-to-country relationships, and Africa is full of countries. In fact, last time I counted, there were 53, but there were some people who think there are 54, and maybe there should be 55, I don't know. What is your answer to this challenge? Can we do business seriously in the development space on a country-by-country basis, or does it have to be regional or sub-regional? And how do we organize that kind of dialogue best? You've mentioned the Green Revolution. Can you do the Green Revolution on a regional basis, sub-regional, or only country-by-country? Let me start with that, and then we'll go and open the floor to others.
Since I can't see people over here with this, I'm going to stand up and answer these questions, if you don't mind. Yeah. That is the way the program was organized before the F process. All of the accounts that did regional funding in AID were gutted because the argument was we shouldn't have any money spent from Washington. Now, I actually shut down a lot of programs in Washington that were not working when I started, but it was based, we did a program review of every single program. There was 175 programs we either shut down or we sent them to the field. But there was another 100 we left in place because we didn't like the CGR system. We didn't want that touched. It was carefully done. We actually went through and we had hearings, and all the officers came in and went through a review who were running these programs. If they couldn't defend the program, and some of these programs had been in existence for some time. So the notion that you should ideologically make put a standard that everything has to be spent locally means regional programs are going to suffer. So I think either you change the F process in terms of the decision-making process, or you move back to the old system where the central bureaus had more money, at least in AID, because we have central bureaus in the three technical competencies in disaster assistance, economic growth, agriculture, and trade, and then we had at health. And if there was regional need for spending, it was done out of these bureaus. Or we have a regional mission in Nairobi called the RETSO office, and that provides technical assistance for, I think, about a third to 40% of the countries that have missions in AID in Africa. And they would do regional programs out of that. So there's a little difference between aid and state on that. I think that Princeton is absolutely correct that AFRICOM, they have more flexibility. You know the PRTs in Afghanistan? They're exempt from the FARs, the Federal Acquisition Regulations. Now, some of you say, who cares, you know? The Federal Acquisition Regulations are now 1,967 pages long. I didn't even know myself until I started doing all of the requirements. You know, we have to comply with all federal labor laws in rural Afghanistan. And we check it. The auditors check. If you don't, you're in very big trouble. People ask why the overhead rates are so high. Look at the FARs. It takes a long time to read 1,987 pages and to be expert on it. I mean, it takes even longer. And by the way, it's getting worse and worse. Every year there's 200 pages more added to the FARs. If you want to do this stuff, you have to comply with these requirements. We have a 60-page book in AID we give to all officers, which have all the congressional requirements under the FARs and statute that they have to comply with. I mean, if you read it, you wonder how we can get anything done at all. So there are serious constraints. DOD got themselves and the PRT completely exempted from the FARs. AID has to comply with them in Afghanistan. They're exempt from them. So, I mean, if you go through all the regulatory stuff, it's very clear why these things are happening. Because they have more flexibility. They're a bigger gorilla. You know what they do in DOD, which we should do? The problem is we don't have enough officers. You know who are the committee staff for the defense appropriation committees and the authorization? They're all officers from the Defense Department. I know we put a few people on the Hill, but we don't staff all the appropriation committees with foreign service officers from aid or state. I can tell you that's not happening, okay? Because we don't have enough of them. Of course they get more flexibility. You have all those officers running everything. They get their orders from the Pentagon. They write it in the bill, and the bill goes through. So there is a dysfunction in the city. You wonder why DOD has got the power it does. It's not just because of the amount of money. They're everywhere.
I think we have a question in the back of the room. Yes, please, Ambassador.
I wasn't going to ask a question, but Mr. Nazio provoked me.
Ambassador, I didn't see you there. I
wasn't offended because at least you didn't say that nothing should be done in the DRC. You talked specifically about a different approach. But I would like for you to elaborate a little bit on the kind of approach that can be applicable for a country such as the DRC, because you have the experience of working with countries in conflict or countries in a post-conflict situation. Thank you.
That's a very good question. I should have looked more carefully at each table before I used examples. I did think I saw the Kenyan ambassador here earlier, so I didn't say anything about Kenya, did I? Okay. What's the approach? I think there actually needs to be more money in fragile states, and I don't know if you dislike that term, but the Congo is a fragile state. It's had a lot of problems, and it's coming out of it now. I think it's in the right trajectory. My good friend Bill Garvelink, who is my best friend in AID, is the ambassador now, and I talk to him all the time, and I visited him, actually, as you know. You helped with my visa. And I think the country is moving in the right direction. But putting more money in the ministries is not a good idea, and I think you know what I'm saying. Now, how would we do it? Well, if you want to focus money in the agriculture sector in the Congo, and I don't know, maybe the agriculture minister is a transformational figure. I don't want to make a judgment. But if the ministry has got real serious problems that don't look like they're about to get solved with local leadership, then you do things privately. If for example, in Afghanistan, the Minister of Agriculture, until the last year, believed in a Stalinist system of agriculture. He wanted us to give all the money. He would buy all the fertilizer for all farmers in Afghanistan and distribute it, which, of course, would never have happened if we had given him the money. So what we did was we went around him to the private markets. And what did we do? We trained the 1,300 fertilizer salesmen in Afghanistan through the research. There's a research center, an NGO in Alabama that does work only in the third world on fertilizer. Because the fertilizer that the Uzbeks were shipping into Afghanistan actually had no fertilizer in it. It was simply junk. And it didn't have any nitrogen, and it was not improving yields at all. And so they didn't even realize what they were selling. So we trained them to show if the, you know, these Uzbek fertilizer sales would come in here with this junk, you can just say, take it back, I'm not buying it. And that, of course, upset the Uzbeks a lot. But it got around the ministry to the people who were importing the fertilizer that was being used in the farms. We also started distributing improved seed varieties to increase wheat yields by 100 to 200% through the seed salesmen in the markets. So you can do things through the private sector, not even just through NGOs. I mean, some will do everything. And NGOs can be very useful in some respects. In other respects, it's better to go to private sector business people. And you need to look at each sector to see what the gaps are. If there's a gap in knowledge, if you don't understand in the ministry, I mean, in the sector, you know, the difference between good and bad fertilizer, well, that knowledge gap, actually, if you fill that and you reinforce people's technical knowledge, they'll protect their own self-interest by shipping or only buying good fertilizer. So there are other options. There are other options. Now, one thing I don't think we're doing enough work on is building institutional capacity, which we did do in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We just stopped doing it, in building institutional capacities in local universities. I tried, but we couldn't get the money for it because money is $800 million earmark, massive increase in earmarks for primary education. I said, what about the teacher training colleges? What if we, and I found out many of these schools train teachers in 6 months. What if we raised this to a year and increased the quality of the curriculum? In other words, what if we worked at the university level to improve the training and the education of people post high school? We started to identify in this book that I'm writing schools that were created by AID in existing universities or new universities, a chain of agricultural schools that we started in the 1960s in India. No one even knows the AID started them now. They were a huge success. They were the basis of the Green Revolution, among other things. But, you know, they're also technical schools, and the new high-tech revolution in India, you know where it came from? Some of these technical schools that we started in the 1960s that have sort of transformed themselves. I think institution building in higher education geared to the human capital needs of the country is a way we could go. And we could create universities, as we do in the United States, that are private, that are detached from the government. Maybe putting in place you'd have to have joint management to make sure things worked right in terms of an endowment. We used to endow things in Eastern Europe all the time. I don't know why we couldn't endow facilities. Maybe have the ambassador, the DCM, or the admission director sit on the board of these colleges jointly to make sure the endowment was focused on the school. But there are ways to do this. There are ways to do it.
Okay. A number of questions on this side, then I'll come back to that side. Pauline.
Thank you, Andrew. That's very enlightening talk you've given us. You did make reference to the reviews that are going on both in the State Department and at the NSC. Could you tell us what the content of those debates are, how they differ, and what you think the options are that they're struggling over? Are they talking about creating USAID as a separate cabinet, you know, DFID style? Are they considering any of the ideas that you've been putting before us? If not, what is this, just a bureaucratic battle?
Before you answer, does anybody else want to piggyback on that question related to the policy reviews and the two-track QDDR and the White House process? Anybody else got a question in that area? Okay.
First, there are two tracks, so I don't know which track you mean. The NSC track, I hope that what comes out of the NSC is the same thing that comes out of the state process, because if they're two different grand strategies for development for the U.S. government, then we're going to have a little problem in which one is operative.
Well, I think there are two tracks and they are independent.
That's correct, and that's a problem, in my view.
There's a Hill track.
That's right. They're rewriting the Foreign Assistance Act, and I keep getting the draft saying, is this all right? I yelled at one of the staffers. because I can do that now. I couldn't yell before at a staffer. Actually, he used to work for me, and he said, I've never had anyone yell at me like this before. And I said, well, I don't, my salary isn't paid by you. I think this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen, this provision you have in here. Why are you doing this? And he was a little upset when he left. But at least he heard. He couldn't forget the conversation. So there's a dueling process that's, I don't know who's going to, the president's going to have to intervene at some point and say, and say this is what needs to come out of this. Because if he doesn't do it, it's going to be chaotic. I might add that some of the things that are being done are fixing things that are not broken, and the things that are broken aren't being fixed. And that's my biggest fear in this. And it's not maliciousness. It is people are listening to the Beltway. If you listen, I come from the NGO camp, but the NGOs will say, we're not getting enough money. The contractors are getting too much money. Okay? Contractors say, oh, they're exaggerating how much we get. We should get less. We should get more money, and the NGOs should get less. Or the universities say, we're not getting enough money. The World Bank is now complaining. There's not any AID money going into trust funds in the bank. There are 1,200 trust funds with $27 billion in the bank. It's causing chaos in the bank, and the bank wants more money from AID for trust funds. It is not a good idea to base your data set on reform on people who are getting assistance from AID or who have an ideological agenda if they're in an advocacy group. I actually think, and I'm not playing to the audience because I know there are a few ambassadors here, I actually suggested this before. I said, why don't you have a closed meeting of the African ambassadors? No press, no notes as to who's saying what. Ask them what they want. Ask them how much money should be in each of the sectors. No, we can't do that. I said, well, you know, you might. They actually do know their countries a little bit better than we do. Why don't you ask them their views? You don't have to do it, but it would be very interesting. I actually thought of, for my book, doing a little survey, and it would be very interesting, the results. I doubt very much that what we're doing is what would come out of those surveys. Because the old aid model was everything's supposed to come up from the field. We make the requests. You respond to the requests from the field. The requests that come up from the field have nothing to do with the amount of money that's sent back. We're ramming money through accounts that we can't possibly spend in the field, and the accounts where we need money in, we get no money in. And so I am afraid they're not going to deal with these larger issues. Maybe they will. Now, I was in one of the meetings, but we were told at the beginning we have to have confidentiality. So I was sworn not to discuss anything at the meeting. I think that's why they asked me to the meeting, so that I couldn't repeat anything to all of you as to what happened in the meetings. I'm a little suspicious now. But Secretary Clinton did say one of the options we're considering is not merging aid into state. But the reality is they're merging the business systems. The business systems that are required for the operation of our embassies is profoundly different than the business systems for AID. You know, the procurement is not a huge part of the state system, but the personnel system is critically important because and information management. That's what the State Department is. It's personnel information management. AID is a program management. The needs are very different. So the gradual merger of the, and this started under Bush, it's continuing now, it's not stopped, is very damaging, I think. I think we should have a department. I've said that, okay? And if you want to coordinate, we have to coordinate this stuff. I'm not of the view that our aid program should be independent of American foreign policy. That's a view, a purist view from Oxfam, and I don't at all take that view. But if you look at things like the Green Revolution, it had a profound effect on the Cold War in Asia. If you look at where we had the Green Revolution, where we invested this huge amount of money, it stopped Mao. It did stop Mao. We know it had an effect on it. There are books being written on it now. So is there a connection between our aid program and foreign policy? Yes, there is. But if you tie the systems of two institutions, state and aid, too closely together in terms of business systems and coordination, you're going to lose something. Justice, I think, is going to be lost. If we start putting – if any management officers are here, this is not a criticism of you, okay, because we've had the same problem. You're going to have a management officer who doesn't know anything about politics – as the ambassador, who's going to do the message delivery to the prime ministers? Who's going to deliver the demarches and understand what their policy, if the political officers are now subordinated way down the chain? So it's what happened in aid in the 1990s. We started putting management people running the mission so we wouldn't have any bad audits. Okay, I think these are the issues we need to, I'm not sure they're looking at it. Maybe they are. For me, if you had a robustly independent aide that reports to the Secretary of State, that works. okay? But that's not what we have now. And I don't know, I don't think that's what's going to come out of this. I think they're going to talk at a more ethereal level in the abstract without considering the institutional and organizational complexity of these issues and what may come out of it. We'll see. I don't want to be, I guess I am being judgmental.
Why don't we take a couple of questions? Hank and Princeton and the lady in green, I'm sorry, I don't have your name. Okay, Hank, the microphone is coming to you, and then Princeton, take a couple of questions on this side so you get a breather, and then we'll go over to this side.
Andrew, ever since we started the destruction of Somalia, I've been following you. Three major speeches were made under the Obama administration on African policy, and all three of them, President, Secretary of State, and Johnny Carson, Assistant Secretary, said that the Green Revolution is going to be our top priority in aid to Africa. Is that doomed because of all the constraints you mentioned?
Princeton, do you want to pose your question, and then we're running short on time here. I don't know if, Jennifer, do we have the room?
Yeah.
So just,
yeah. Andrew, I'd like to ask you a different question for which you're particularly qualified. We've been talking about conflict earlier today. There is a moral dilemma about humanitarian aid in conflict. That is, of course, you don't want people to die, et cetera. But to the extent that humanitarian aid, in effect, keeps people alive so the warring parties don't have to take responsibility for their people, it does, in effect, subsidize the war, the conflict. I wonder, you've done so much humanitarian work. How do you see that dilemma?
What was the first question? I don't. If the President of the United States calls up the Appropriation Committee Chairman for Foreign Ops in the House and the Senate and says, leave the agriculture money in the budget, they'll leave it in. But it's going to require a presidential call. The fear I have is there could be strings attached. No chemical fertilizer, no irrigation, you know, go back to Paleolithic, Neolithic agriculture, which, frankly, is what some people advocate. If you read some of the people, and it's not all the NGOs. I mean, TechnoServe and all are doing the right stuff. But some of them take this view that modern scientific agriculture is a bad idea. I think it's utter nonsense. It's utter nonsense. No agricultural scientist who's serious or economist believes that, Hank. So it's not just the money. It's what strings come with it. Because the staffs couldn't very well insinuate themselves into the drafting of the appropriation in a way that will do what, you know. And if that happens, then the money, you can have all the money in the world. If you have those kind of restrictions, it's not going to work very well. Is it doomed? I don't know. And I don't know whether the call is being made. I know what they said, and I applauded them when they said it publicly. But all I care about is what's in the account when it finally gets to Africa. And then it's going to be sent to the right countries. If you send into a Marxist system agricultural development money, you're wasting a lot of money because the policies are going to impede any development. If you're in a country that's now moving to a private market system and the Ministry of Agriculture is a transformational figure, as he is in Afghanistan right now, that's a different matter. So where it's sent is as important as how much is sent and what strings are attached. Now, you may think in my class at Georgetown that I teach unconstrained humanitarian assistance with no limitations, but I don't teach that. What I teach it to my students is, in fact, we had a case on the moral dilemmas of aid. The last lecture for 2 hours was on this subject. And I went through a set of the international system's standards for trying to ensure this stuff doesn't happen, but I said these are very weak and they're unenforceable. And so the question is, if you're an aid officer and you're making judgments, what you should do. And I went through, actually, I used my staff, there are some Catholics, even though it's a Catholic university, in my class, but most of them are not. And I'm not Catholic, but Catholic social teaching does actually, on just war theory, some of the principles on proportionality and a few other things are applicable, interestingly enough, to humanitarian assistance, even though St. Augustine never, or St. Thomas never considered that when they wrote these treatises on just war theory. It's very interesting. If you look at these doctrines, they do have application. You have to, on just war theory, believe that the outcome of the war will improve the situation given that there's going to be violence if the war takes place. In other words, you'll have to have a better situation when you finish than when you start. I asked that question. I said, what happened in Goma was unacceptable. What happened in Goma in the 1990s, and I was in the NGO committee, we had a huge yelling match. I got back from Goma. I said, this food is all being diverted by the Hutu gendarmerie that caused the atrocities in the first place in Rwanda. And they're distributing the food. And we, in my NGO, and all the other NGOs, were using the established authority structure in the camps. What was the established authority structure? It was the old Habyarimana clique that carried out the genocide. What were they doing? They were taking some of the food and buying weapons with it. There's a very famous UNHCR study that Gene Dewey commissioned that was suppressed by UNHCR later. It was so embarrassing, which said a very large amount of money food is being diverted to buy weapons with. And I said, in that case, my judgment was we should have shut down the whole thing. Because the people are so close to the border, they could have walked home. We should have phased it out. A lot of women were only getting food if they gave, you know, sexual favors to the men distributing the food. It was an appalling situation. How did it all end? Kagame ended it all by sending the Rwandan army was sent in to shut down the camps with a relatively small loss of life. I didn't support it, because that's not why you shut down camps. But I have to say, given what was happening in the aid community, had I been administrator, I think I would have said this is enough. I did shut down the North Korea program that I helped start when I was in the NGO community, because I sent I won't mention his name, some of you know him, he's very famous in the aid community. He discovered the atrocities of Renamo in Mozambique. Bob Hodak brought him into Uganda to find out the atrocities. I think some of you know. I sent him to the North Korean border. I said, don't write a report because it'll get leaked in 5 minutes. I want to know where our food is going. He said 40-60% is being diverted to the military. He came back after 4 months. That's what he told me. But he never wrote it down because it was leaked within a week after he came back. There's this report. I said, there's no report. Doesn't exist. There's no piece of paper. And I gradually phased it out because there was no famine. There was no reason to have this food aid continue except for diplomatic reasons. And WFP wanted it for the wrong reasons. And there was no nutritional reason to have it, in my view. And secondly, it was being diverted, and therefore we shut it down. So I agree with you. I think you have to do it on an individual basis, but I think if you have a set of principles to guide your decision, it would make a more informed decision that's morally correct. If you are making the war worse, shut the program down. But you need to consider what's going to be the consequence when you do that. So I don't think the questions were that hard, Princeton, because of your students in my classes on this subject, because I think we may agree more than you realize.
Andrew, I think we have reached that point. If this was a national symphony, we might have an encore, but instead of doing that, what we're going to do is invite those who didn't get a chance to ask a question to come up and tug on your sleeve. But I want to say thank you to Jennifer and your colleagues, Richard Downey and others who helped to organize this part of the program, and to Bob Newman and Bill Harrop on the AA, and Liz Beryl on the AAD side. This has been a good event, and thanks especially to our speaker for provoking a great lunch conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.